In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You've found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 403. Today we are joined once again by Professor Jeff Herbener. Jeff is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College, and I want to talk to him about an article that some of you have seen and a lot of people have read and talked about, and that's an article by another guest of this show, Brian Kaplan, called Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist. So Jeff Herbener and I are going to go through and look at this article. It's going to take a bunch of episodes. It's long, and we want to give it its due. We want to go through each point one at a time. So we're going to do that beginning today. Jeff is also a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and he is associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. Of course, he's also a faculty member at mylibertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you, in courses you can listen to on the go, taught by people you can trust, and of course you get a discount as a listener of this show when you use coupon code SHOW in all caps at libertyclassroom.com. Jeff Herbener, welcome back to the show.
Hey Tom, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've had many, many people say to me, what do you say to Brian Kaplan in his famous article? And I thought, well, I'm always badgering Bob Murphy to get on the show, and doggone it, the guy has other things to do also. You know, he's not just on the Tom Woods Show. So who's my number two guy to badger? Well, Jeff Herbener, of course. Liberty Classroom faculty member and guy whom I have not stumped in 20 years of asking questions. So you are the lucky man to help us go through this. This is we will link to it, of course, on the show notes page for today, which is tomwoods.com/403, because, Jeff, this is episode number 403
wow.
of the show.
Very impressive.
How about that?
Yeah.
So people can read this article for themselves. It'll be linked at tomwoods.com/403. And we're actually going to do it in order. And so this means that maybe I'll badger you once a month for the next, you know, give you something to do over the summer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we're going to start with Foundations of Microeconomics. And do not turn off the podcast, all right? I am ordering you, as regular listeners of the show, do not be put off by this. I know you're tempted to turn the thing off because you want to hear us talk about business cycles and traditional topics, but this foundational stuff is very important. And according to Kaplan, Murray Rothbard just gets all of it wrong. He doesn't understand welfare economics. He doesn't understand all kinds of questions that are discussed in mainstream economics. So we want to evaluate all this. Tell us, first of all, explain to the audience, when we use the terms utility functions and value scales, what do these two things mean? The Austrians talk about value scales. Tell us what these two things mean.
Okay, well, let's start, as you say, with value scales. So the Austrian view is to take the human person as the starting point of economic analysis, and then we begin the analysis by gathering up all that we can know about human action just by reflecting upon our own actions. And in that process, we hit upon this notion of choice, of course, that in action we make choices to use our means to attain some ends and forego the attainment of other ends, and that we choose between competing sets of means to attain the same end. And this choice is based upon preference that we have that's bound up in this choice, that we prefer one alternative to another. So that's what a value scale is. A value scale is just our analysis of the idea that we're choosing and valuing one alternative that we choose more highly than an alternative option that we forego in action. So this is all, from the Austrian viewpoint, grounded in the reality of the human person and the circumstances of action and the nature of choice. Now, utility functions are entirely different. Utility functions are constructed as an arbitrary arrangement of utility or value that is embedded in fictitious agents. So all the neoclassical approach to explaining the real world of economics begins with agents that are assumed to have particular ways of valuing things. And so it isn't the association of means and ends, particular things that we're using as human beings to attain particular ends, but the neoclassical economist assumes that they're these economic agents that are able to place a value on all of the different combinations of means that or things that exist in the world. And so these agents are able, or the assumption is that these agents are able to make comparisons between the value that they would place upon all sorts of different combinations of goods. Whether or not these combinations of goods are associated with particular actions that particular people would be taking. It's a little bit hard to wrap your head around this distinction, but perhaps we can use a concrete illustration. So with the Austrian approach, we would say, let's look at a human person who is in particular circumstances and then chooses an end. He's hungry, and so he wants to eat lunch, and he chooses a chicken wrap for lunch. And the means that he chooses, the chicken wrap, he values with respect to the end that is attained. So there's this connection that the human person creates between the ends and the means. The agent, though, of the models of the neoclassical school would value the chicken wrap as a bundle of within a bundle of all the other goods that exist, with the ability to, this agent has the ability to value all the different combinations of different amounts of the good, like half of a chicken wrap with a bag of apples, with an automobile, with a house that the person owns, and so on and so forth, and then minutely changing each of these amounts, so two chicken wraps and two bags of apples and six cars and so on and so forth, and then decide whether or not each of the bundles of goods has more or less value than any other bundle. So the fundamentally, these are two entirely different approaches to the whole question of valuing and choosing and acting.
This is probably my Austrian prejudice coming in, but the value scale approach seems so much more commonsensical and seems to be more understandable from the point of view of ordinary life.
Right. So that's an excellent point. I mean, why go through all this rigmarole? And the answer to this, I think, is that it harkens back to what Milton Friedman claimed about mathematical logic, that if we can put, he thought, economic arguments in mathematical language, then it's possible to give strict demonstrable proof of conclusions that flow within the model, within the mathematical structure of the model. And that this is superior to merely verbal reasoning, where there are all sorts of difficulties and fallacies and so on and so forth that don't, he thinks, enter into mathematical logic. Now, whatever one might say about that kind of a claim, it still leaves open the question, as you suggest, of what all of this has to do, all this mathematical treatment has to do with explaining real, real human action and real economies.
Let's talk about what Kaplan is saying with regard to Rothbard's criticism of utility functions and Rothbard's preference for value scales. So value scales are high on Rothbard's value scale, apparently. So he's saying that Rothbard is critical of utility functions because he believes that economists using them are conceiving of utility in a cardinal sense, as there being units of utility, whereas Rothbard claims that utility is ordinal. You can't say how much more, in terms of some fixed unit, you value an ice cream cone to a bottle of wine or something, but you can simply say that you prefer one to the other. And Kaplan says this is a complete misunderstanding. There is no cardinal utility being used in these utility functions. So who's right?
Well, this is might be that Kaplan has a point here, but again, if we accept his view, which is the standard neoclassical position, that you can use mathematical techniques called representation theorems to show that a mathematical function that does in fact have cardinal elements to it is merely a representation of an ordinal ranking system, if you accept this claim, then Kaplan is correct. Now, whether or not one should accept this claim in a broader sense, whether this is just a kind of a narrow mathematical proof or whether it's a acceptable philosophically, I think is a different matter. So Rothbard, I think, here is just taking the commonsensical view that if you say we have utility functions and utility is one of the dependent variable in the function, then it has to have cardinal numbers. Otherwise, the whole functional analysis is rather pointless. So from a kind of commonsensical view, and again, from various, philosophical positions one might take, this seems to be a legitimate criticism. Now, if Kaplan's argument, if we accept Kaplan's argument that representation theorems sort of get around this problem by showing that if I ordinarily rank things, I can from that construct a mathematical function that preserves the ordinal ranks, and therefore I can use the mathematical function in analysis if one accepts all that, which again I don't think one has to, but if one accepts all that, then one still has this problem that I alluded to earlier, that there has to be, in order for this to work, there has to be a complete and continuous ordering of preferences behind the mathematical function so that when you construct the mathematical function, it's completely and utterly continuous. And you need this kind of continuity in order to do calculus and other mathematical operations on these functions. So that then becomes the telling point against this approach. Is it really reasonable that we can model human beings by agents who not only can rank every conceivable bundle of goods that they might possess, but can do so in infinitesimally small changing amounts across all of the goods that they own or potentially could own? This seems, again, quite remotely connected to real human beings.
Before we go on, let me ask you, what are the real world, well, for economic theory anyway, the real world implications of this difference of opinion that you would have with Kaplan and with other economists? If they have this view and they use this type of functional analysis, how does that affect the way they do economics? So how does that, because this all seems like very abstract theory. What are the practical implications of this way of thinking?
Well, I think the practical implications come in the nature of what economic analysis becomes when you treat it as functional. So once you say that what we have are functions and we can use mathematical analysis, you're led then inevitably to the view that economic analysis is really doing empirical prediction and empirical hypothesis testing. And so you've reduced economics to just a predictive, a practical kind of predictive device that would be, in fact, useful or even supplanting of the entrepreneur. Basically, economic analysis is now doing prediction of, you know, what the patterns of demands will be, what will be profitable and what will not. You could replace all political decision making with predictions based on modeling, and so on and so forth. So that is a completely different conception of what the usefulness of economic theorizing and economic analysis is. The Austrians hold that economic analysis tells us really about the meaning of human action. It tells us about the underlying economic laws that govern the social order and so on, and are not particularly useful, at least on the theoretical level, not particularly useful for making empirical predictions.
I'm going to skip indifference for the moment because he has a section on continuity, and given that we just hit on that, we might as well touch that. He says, he quotes Rothbard, human beings act on the basis of things that are relevant to their action. The human being cannot see the infinitely small step. It therefore has no meaning to him and no relevance to his action. And of course, with calculus, you're dealing with infinitely small steps. And then Kaplan says, okay, but without continuous preferences, it's also highly unlikely that, for example, supply and demand can ever be equal. If you draw the supply and demand curves continuously, then they are almost bound to intersect. But if you draw them as a discrete set of points, supply and demand in general don't have to intersect. Thus, the argument against calculus based upon the rejection of continuity also argues against even the use of simple algebraic constructs like intersecting supply and demand lines that fill Rothbard's works.
Yeah, here I think Kaplan's just made a mistake. I don't think it's correct to draw the conclusion from discrete demand and supply curves, non-continuous supply and demand curves, that they don't intersect or that you wouldn't get the analysis of market clearing that both the neoclassical and the Austrians hold to. That just seems to me to be mistaken. You'd still have the law of demand, you'd still have the law of supply, even if you work, as the Austrians do, in discrete units. And while you don't have continuous curves, the discrete patterns would intersect, and markets would, in fact, clear. And what we're trying to, of course, explain is the real world of prices that we see. We're not trying to establish particular conditions of the analytical device. We're trying to explain the real world. So if we see prices in the real world and we can analyze them as clearing, just through the logic of what would happen if prices were higher, we'd get excess supply, or what would happen if prices were lowered, in the market, we'd get excess demand at that point. So markets clear, we see this just as a matter of logic, and this isn't relevant, I don't think his point is relevant. The other thing is that Rothbard explicitly says that his use of smooth continuous curves is just a pedagogical device, and so it's just a way of nicely illustrating the basic laws of economics.
All right, let's talk about indifference curves, very important to neoclassical theory. Rothbard rejects them, and he is quoted here as saying, "The crucial fallacy is that indifference cannot be a basis for action. If a man were really indifferent between two alternatives, he could not make any choice between them, and therefore the choice could not be revealed in action." And then Kaplan goes on to say, "The crucial assumption, shared by both Mises and Rothbard, is that no preference can exist which cannot be revealed in action. But why assume this?" And then he goes on and on. Now, I'm not sure, correct me on this, Jeff, but I'm not sure they're saying no preference can exist which cannot be revealed in action. I think they're saying that no preference that an economist can do anything with, it would have to be revealed in action for the economist to find its something that could be studied. I mean, to speculate on what may be floating around in my mind is not what economics is about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So here again, I think Kaplan's just made a mistake. There's an ambiguity in the way that he's using the word preference. So Rothbard and Mises use the word preference, as you point out, to refer to the choice that a person makes in action. So we just, that's just a definition of the word preference. Preference is what's revealed or demonstrated when a person chooses between alternatives. Now, all the other aspects of the state of mind of the person who's making the choice, the economists can say nothing about. That would just be a psychological question. As to Kaplan goes on with an example where he says, if I may be indifferent between choosing a green sweater and a blue sweater, but I still choose one or the other. But this again is just using the word preference in a different way. So sure, a person could be, it could be just only incidentally important, or it could be unimportant to the person which color sweater, but the person chooses the sweater, and that's where the preference would be indicated. And if a person were psychologically indifferent toward green or blue, then that's just not part of economic analysis, because that's not part of choice.
What is the purpose of indifference curves, and do you think that this argument, that given that action demonstrates preference, not indifference, is the key argument against indifference curves?
No, I think the key argument against indifference curves, we mentioned before, it's that in order to construct them, we have to have agents who have this, we assume, the ability to value all different bundles of goods of all different infinitesimal amounts in order to establish either a preference or an indifference. The bundle ordering of value must be entirely complete. And I think that's where the basic flaw of the analysis comes in. Indifference is used only to show the maximum utility point of choice in the neoclassical system. So I don't think it's indifference curves per se that are the problem or the main problem. I think it's the whole notion that we can model real human beings in their choices and actions by using these fictitious agents.
I think we'll skip welfare economics, because we should probably do a whole episode on welfare economics, given that you've written on it, and it's not an easy topic, and Kaplan thinks that Rothbard's important article on the subject just gets everything all wrong. So I would definitely want to revisit this in the future to do an episode on welfare economics. But just to finish up the section here, let's see if I did actually get to everything. Okay, yeah. Just to finish up this section on micro foundations, he has a little bit here on subjectivism. He says, innumerable Austrian essays and books use the word subjectivism in the title. This leaves one with the impression that other economists fail to embrace subjectivism, an impression that is simply false. What neoclassical economist claims that the value of a good derives from its labor content or its intrinsic goodness or anything other than individuals' preferences? It is true that academic papers often abstract from the heterogeneity of preferences, but this is merely a simplifying assumption. To assume, e.g., that everyone has the same log-linear utility function is on par with assuming that the world contains only two people, Crusoe and Friday. It is not a statement about the world, but a method of focusing on one particular problem. Neoclassical economists' propensity to declare certain situations inefficient may superficially appear to violate subjectivism. As mentioned earlier, this is because efficiency has a technical definition somewhat different from its meaning in ordinary conversation. Does he score any points here?
Yeah, no, I don't think he does. Again, the distinction between the Austrian and the neoclassical treatment of these, of this idea of subjectivism is rests on a different foundation. So when Austrians talk about subjectivism, they just mean that the valuing that a person does, a real human person does in choice, it resides in his mind, that he just makes a judgment of his mind. Whereas subjectivism in the neoclassical sense, as you were reading, just is an assumption about the utility functions between two different persons. So some assumption must be made about what the configuration of the utility one person has relative to another. So, for example, different individuals might have exactly the same utility functions, but subjectively their marginal utility, as the neoclassicals would say, would be different if they have different amounts of goods. And that would be sufficient, in their view, for exchange to take place, let's say, between two people. One who had more of a good would value a unit of it less, and then another person who had a different good in greater supply would place less value on a unit of it and then would trade. But this is really just a, as Kaplan seems to say, it's really just a an assumption that's made about the configuration of the agent's utility assessment, whereas in the Austrian view, we're talking about real human judgment, and this again is a fundamental difference that sort of, I think, puts to rest, or at least is a very sharp distinction between the Austrian view and the neoclassical functional analysis, because the one thing that Kaplan doesn't mention throughout this article, and the point that Mises stressed about functional analysis, is that functional analysis must assume that there are constants in the quantitative relationships of human action. And that's precisely what subjectivism does not permit, because subjectivism says that it takes human judgment to ascertain the value of all the different elements of action. And this human judgment is changeable. And if that is so, then there can't be constants between different sets of data or quantitative magnitudes in the results of human action.
This article covers so many topics that are particularly juicy for the audience. So when we get to it, and I hope you will join me periodically to,
sure,
to walk through it, we're going to get to the topics that everybody wants to hear. There's compared to the other sections, a very lengthy discussion and criticism of Austrian theory of the business cycle.
Right.
That will be very useful to go through. There's a criticism of the Austrian method, the praxeological method.
Mm-hmm.
That will be useful so that people, first of all, understand the Austrian method and then see criticisms of it responded to. Economic calculation. I'm actually having Matt Mahai on, who has an interesting take on the economic calculation argument of Mises against socialism, having him on next week to talk about that. So
great.
We'll look at what Kaplan has to say about that. Monopoly theory. There's a lot of great stuff coming up. I'm tempted to jump into the socialist calculation thing, but I think we've spent enough time. I'll let you go. On the show notes page, tomwoods.com/, let's see, what is this again? 403. We will link to this article so that you can follow along both in this episode and for the episodes to come. Also, of course, if you want to learn real economics, well, then you want to learn it from Jeff Herbiner, who can bat down every objection you could possibly raise over at libertyclassroom.com, where, Jeff, not only did you do the introductory course on Austrian economics, but you did a course that we did a whole episode on here in which you went through the Samuelson Nordhaus economics textbook, which is extremely widely used, and you went through and gave an Austrian critique chapter by chapter. Nothing like that's ever been done, and all of mankind is grateful to you for that. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Tom, for providing the opportunity for these outlets.
Very glad to do it, and I appreciate your time today. We're going to get you back on sooner than you'd probably like, but I'm going to twist your arm and get you back on here. Thanks again.
No, I look forward to it every time. Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody, that's the show for today, and that is another week of programming. Don't forget, all you homeschoolers, here's how you get free stuff. If you join the Ron Paul curriculum, join it through ronpaulhomeschool.com. That's my special link so I can keep track of who's listening and doing what I say, basically. But if you go to ronpaulhomeschool.com and then you go ahead and join after that, and you drop me a note through my website, tomwoods.com, I will send you an autographed copy of The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, plus I'll send you a free 10-lesson bonus course on the foundations of liberty to help get your junior high student excited for this curriculum. So two free bonuses, but to get those bonuses, you have to enter the site via ronpaulhomeschool.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.